Welcome to Alchemical Dialogues, an Amber Light podcast. Join Dr. Henry Critella and Iqbal Jonathan Lewis for their discussion on finding your own way. The information provided on this website and these podcasts is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this website and in these podcasts is intended to be a substitute for medical, health, therapeutic, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the guests in these podcasts are not necessarily the opinions of Amber Light International and anyone associated with this organization.
So welcome to our Alchemical Dialogues. And thank you, Iqbal. Finally, we did it.
Yes, we did do it. And you're more than welcome.
For people who don't know Iqbal, Iqbal is a dear friend who I met. When did we go to Israel? Was that 10 years ago?
At least.
Wow. Time flies. But we're not childhood friends, but I feel like I've known him forever. So he's followed a Sufi path and was one of the original followers of Murshid Samuel Lewis, who's one of the American Sufis that a lot of us have followed. And he's also followed some Zen masters. But more importantly, he's followed himself and his inner guidance. And in his bio, he said, "What does any of that have to do with Iqbal Lewis?" And it's the teacher's illumination is not the student's, but it helps enormously to study with a realized teacher. When we talked about this podcast, part of what Iqbal and I have talked about a lot, actually, is what that really means about who you are and how you find who you are, how you realize who you are. Maybe that's a better way of putting it. So how do you find who you really are?
You find who you are by looking for who you are, but what you're searching for has really never been lost. It's a misconception to think you can find something. In my experience, if you don't look, then maybe you won't find it. And as I say to people, even though there's nothing to find, and even though you might not find anything, it's a lot of fun looking.
It's a lot of pain looking too.
Come on, dude. It's the pain is if you don't look. But if you look, okay, so part of looking is this. Eventually, you start to get this story. The story is that it's the divine looking for the divine, which is true. It's God looking for God. And then the story increases that everything inside you is the divine. And then everything outside you, although we call it Maya, which is because we believe it's outside us, is also the divine. And so there might be some pain and suffering involved, but ultimately it's a wonderful journey. Even if you're crapped up, then who's crapped you up? None other than God. And, you know, I don't buy it when they say, you made a mistake and then you're suffering. And but that's one way of looking at it. But what if you didn't make a mistake? And what if the universe, the being that produces all of us and the universe and the mistakes and the mountains and the valleys, it's just what it is. The other day, just to continue talking, I hit a down spot. And a lot of my stuff was up in my face. And then I picked up Ram Dass, Papa Ram Dass, and there was everything that I was experiencing, including complaining about people and distrusting everything. And I was amazed because there I was, conceit, fretfulness, and ill temper. And I thought, oh my goodness, that's how I'm feeling right now. And Papa Ram Dass goes on to say, they're not the signs of spiritual advancement, but I took it to mean they're the signs of getting stuck. So recognizable by a great illuminated soul that he's warning you. If you get in a room with these three things, conceit, fretfulness, and ill temper, then it's time to recognize it and move on. So that's what I mean. And so I was happy to read it. Devastated, of course, because of my conceit, but happy that I had been nailed and called out. And then, you know, I could move on.
I think part of what I remember about the time we spent in Israel that we talked about before we started recording, where we would have these long breakfasts. I mean, no kidding. They were like 3 hours with really great food at this hotel. And then we would go explore the old city. That was one of the highest points in my life. I had so much fun being with you and Davey and Kathleen. And it wasn't just fun. It wasn't just, oh, we were having a good time. It was, we had some really long talks and great stories. And I felt like I was finding part of myself that I had kept hidden for most of my life. And it came out because of the people we were with, because we were together as a foursome and something happened. The feeling you have when you get unstuck and you realize how you felt when you were stuck, you start to see, oh, look at that. We probably talked about some esoteric stuff, but it's not like we were super serious, pious, folding our hands, bowing our heads. You know, there's a place for that, but we were laughing and having fun and talking about our life and what happened to us and what we're doing with it and what was important. So that's what I remember about our trip. And I think that's what you're talking about.
What am I talking about?
Being unstuck and being free.
In other words, one of the, one of my pet peeves, the issue with America, and we'll say, and psychology and therapy, as I understand it, is that you're never quite good enough and that you always need to spend time correcting and changing and understanding. But when you're okay, well, maybe it serves its purpose. But what happens when, I think what you're describing is when you sit with your friends and you are good enough. In fact, you're better than good enough. You're perfect. And the conversation just flows. And no one says to you, my goodness, are you suffering trauma from your childhood, which backs you up? It's not, I'm not saying it's not valuable, which is a change of tune. But I am saying that, yeah, when you sit down and have a 3-hour breakfast and drink tons of that little Arabic espresso filled with sugar, you know, and you can just like BS, why not? That's as valuable as anything.
So we had another time when we, from my point of view, I was asking for your advice and your help. And we had some pretty serious discussions. And we talked some about what I was into and my past and what was leading to this and that. It's not like we didn't have or couldn't have serious discussions that were like you were just talking about in traditional psychology. But there was a hopefulness with it. And there was it was serious and laughing at the same time. And just being together, that was really special, that I really felt. And again, I think what we're getting to is there's kind of a naturalness, the way that I think I'm hearing you talk about it. When you find yourself, there's a flow and there's a naturalness. And whether it comes out being serious or it comes out laughing or being rowdy, it just kind of flows. It's not artificial. It's not anything forced about it. Does that make sense?
Perfectly. The thing is, everybody, and I mean everybody, has Buddha nature, which means everybody has Buddha nature, which means all of you who are listening to this have Buddha nature. And according to the Buddha, if you realize it, then you become the Buddha at that moment. And one thing that happens when you start to have spiritual experiences, you start to realize God's perfection is you. So what's the hang up? It's like Murshid Sam tells the story. Well, it's the same story that Wei Ning tells, if I can just go on this for a minute. So Wei Ning, who's the father of Zen, he's a young kid. He's not so young. He's 20. He walks into a store. He hears some monks chanting the Diamond Sutra. He becomes immediately illuminated. He wakes up right on the spot. Blah, 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 blah. They send him to go see the fifth patriarch. He walks in and the fifth patriarch says to him, who are you? And he said, I'm Wei Ning. And he said, where are you from? He said the South. So the fifth patriarch says, the South? What are you doing here? They don't read in the South. They can't speak proper languages. What are you doing here? It's like the land of ignoramuses. To which Wei Ning, having says to him, in Buddha nature, there is no North or South. There is no difference between one who can speak and one who cannot. So the fifth patriarch thinks, uh-oh, because those days, if you showed illumination, they would kill you. So he sends him in the kitchen, fast forward, blah, 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 blah. The fifth patriarch's going to die, and he's looking for his successor. He holds a contest, and he says, whoever can write on the wall a phrase that shows me you're illuminated, I'll make you the sixth patriarch. So the head monk writes, our body is a Bodhi tree, our mind a mirror bright. Carefully wipe them hour by hour and let no dust alight. You know, I take that like what we do. We're always working, we're this and that. So long story, Wei Ning reads it. He says, both the fifth patriarch reads it. He says, this guy doesn't have it, even though it's his main disciple. And Wei Ning gets to the hall and he writes, there is no Bodhi tree, nor stand of mirror bright. Since all is void, which I translate for this, since all is God, where can the dust alight? So that's the point. If all is God, if all is void, if all is perfect, where's the imperfection?
Right. You lived with Murshid Sam, and after he died, you said you hung around with Joe Miller, who was a vaudevillian who was also a Zen master. After he died, you hung out for a long time, right, with another Zen master. So I don't know if you would call that training. You know, that's the word that gets used nowadays. But you were with some really powerful people in powerful situations. So, you know, a lot of people are on a spiritual path, and, you know, the paths differ, but some of them are rather rigid, and there's a clear hierarchy and a lot of mannerisms and things that you're supposed to do or not supposed to do. What was your experience being with these illuminated teachers? Just describe what your experience was.
Well, each one of those, Murshid Sam, Joe Miller, who I spent the most time with, 20 years, Don Gilbert, 10 years, each one of those was recognized to be in this, as Zen masters in this line, going back to Wei Ning. That's the first thing. So do I think of it as a training? I do, because each one came at me from their own illumination, but completely natural. For example, I lived with Murshid Sam. One day I walked by him and he said to me, right out of the blue, like, sleep's a concept. Said, sleep's a concept. So I walked on and I thought, took me five decades, and I thought he meant going to sleep's a concept, you know, like sleeping at night, which I accepted. Okay, if he said it, fine. You know, I'll work it out. But what I've begun to realize that when he says sleep is a concept, he also meant the concept of awakening is a concept. If sleep's a concept, then awakening's a concept. So if there's no sleep and there's no awakening, there's ever-present being. The divine doesn't sleep. Only we think we sleep, but we don't sleep. And there's a place in there that never, as Wei Ning says, if all is void, where can the dust alight? There's a place, there's Buddha nature that's ever existent, ever awake, ever, ever, ever. And that's what we are. We just don't know it. I met Don Gilbert, who was the third in the line, and someone claimed the 77th patriarch in this line. You know, I met him and he gets in the back of the car and everything becomes here. And I thought, it was the first time I was just hanging out with him. And I thought, oh, I get it. You don't have to do anything to be with this guy. Zero. And the more you do, the less you'll meet him.
Hmm. Was it like that with Murshid Sam?
Murshid Sam was a living tornado. It was like that with Joe Miller. Because if you started to think of Joe as a great teacher, you lost him. If you thought of Joe Miller as your friend, you had him. And one day I was walking along and I tried this experiment. oh, Joe, and he disappeared. Joe, and he was here. And so I went back and forth till it became obvious that if you accepted him as your friend, and he used to always say, this is my friend, Iqbal, you know, that's where he was, then I can have him. Otherwise, I couldn't have him. Murshid, Sam, he was a different story. And anyway, I was different. I had just come from New York. I didn't know up from down and back from forward, nothing. And there I was living with this incredibly realized, powerful, unabashed, brilliant Sufi Zen master. So I always say that I was just, and that's what he said when he first met me. He said to Wali Ali, creating a personality is difficult work. And I felt, because of the spiritual experience I had in New York, Mariel, Shabadeen, that I came to him, I was like a blank slate, dough in his hand, the Pillsbury boy. And living with him, he just created me. He yelled. So I learned it was, it's not that he yelled and hurt my feelings, but I learned he was honest. So the message was, be honest. If you want to be like your teacher, be like your teacher. Doesn't mean you have to know what he knows or any of that stuff. But it meant he was honest. I was honest. He told the truth. I told the truth. He didn't stand for fake teachers. I wasn't supposed to stand for fake teachers. And so he kind of sharpened my sword. He acknowledged my sense of discrimination. Bullshit's bullshit. And he said, that's bullshit. But I'd already thinking was bullshit. The same thing with Joe Miller, even more so.
Murshid Sam wrote a lot, not just his correspondence, which was like
voluminous.
I know. But he also wrote teachings. So it wasn't like there was not any content. He wrote volumes of commentary, right? So you're emphasizing how with Pym and with Joe Miller, who I guess didn't write as much, if at all, they modeled something and you picked it up from being around them. But at the same time, like I'm thinking of a lot of spiritual paths that a lot of us have been involved in, where there's a lot of content, things that you're supposed to learn. So Murshid Sam had that.
Yes, and he did.
You didn't ignore that.
I didn't ignore it. Is that what you just said to me?
Yes, that's what I said.
I did ignore it. I mean, if you want to be honest, I totally ignored it. I didn't care what he wrote. What did I care? I just did ignore it. And now in my latter years, I'm not ignoring it so much. And that's true. But because it's like confirmation and something's different. But at the beginning, why would I read Murshid if I lived with him?
No, that's the point.
There was no sense.
Did you go to his classes?
I went to all his classes. I went to the classes he let me go to. You know, I wasn't just because I lived there, it wasn't like it was carte blanche. And, you know, I once said to him, well, can I come to the Saturday night dance class, which is the highest, most refined class? And he said, no. So I used my time. This is funny. I used my time to go out in San Francisco with Wahid, who was a friend of ours who had hair like this and was living in San Francisco. And that's how, you know, I'd spend the Saturday night dance class just tripping around San Francisco.
So what did you get out of the classes at the time?
Oh, touches of mastery. And I mean it. I didn't go to the Saturday dance class. He wouldn't allow it. Did it hurt my feelings? You're not even asking that question. Nah, it was no, but that was that. No sense arguing with Sam Lewis. But the other classes, let's assume for the sake of this conversation that Murshid meant what he said, Murshid Sam. And what he said was, Anayat Khan told him that he, Sam Lewis, was the proof that his teachings worked. And then Murshid would say, Sam Murshid, he would say, but no one will believe it in the Sufi order. No one will believe that. They say, that can't be. He said, but that's what Anayat Khan said to me. So let's assume that I was living with a real master who said some things like this to me. He said, before I took the title of Murshid, I had an illuminated disciple. How about that? One day during dance class, when it was over, he walked by me and he said, "My God, I'm very high." And then he turned to me and he said, "I hope you all are high." He said, "After all," he said, "I'm the master teacher and I'm supposed to get you high." So at that moment, he took full responsibility for who he was, the titles he owned, and what he was able and capable of delivering to his students. It was totally not a game, and there was no posturing. So what I learned in his classes, like when we did the astrological walks, every once in a while you touch one. And if you touched one, you touched them all. And if you touched one, then you realize that they work for you. And that's just one example. So you live with someone who's real, and you go to a real class, and every once in a while something real happens.
So maybe the other stuff around that, the content, is just something to have an experience. I don't know if I said that right.
Well, it helps. You know, on one hand, Murshid Sam said reading is useless. And then he went on to say, but the words, when I read Anayat Khan, the words in some holy scriptures, the words jumped off the pages, became light and whirled around me. And I was like, well, that's not bad. I thought that works. Joe Miller read everybody, everything. If you read his book,
Great Song,
you'll see that it's, you know, he's touched everything. Don Gilbert knew everything. I mean, he was vastly, I know that because his wife sent us a book, which I have, of things she collected, and it's from every religion imaginable. Not imaginable, but so yeah. If you want to read, read, but know that it's just pushing you toward waking up. You don't read it and then say, God, look what I know. You read it and say, wow, who wrote that? What did they know?
Yeah, you make it an experience. It's not just intellectual.
No, it's not intellectual.
Right. Since you referenced my long background in psychiatry, one of the things that it took me a while to catch on to is that, so when I trained early in psychiatry, it was still kind of Freudian psychodynamic kinds of stuff for psychotherapy. And so we did all this reading and trying to understand Sigmund Freud and what he was thinking and da, 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 da. And it took a while. And then it kind of dawned on us that all of the stuff that you have when you're doing therapy is to awaken something in the relationship. And if it doesn't wake up in the relationship, it doesn't get anywhere, or at least it's very limited in terms of where it gets. It's not that that wasn't said, it's that we didn't get it. It took a long time to get it that when therapy works, it's the relationship that works. Something gets kindled in the relationship, something wakes up, and it's in both parties. It's not like the therapist changes. You know, you have a relationship, you jump into something together and you have some guidelines and you decide on some stuff to talk about that's important. But it isn't the intellectual stuff. It's what it does in the relationship that changes something. And that's what I hear you talking about. There was something special about these people and the relationship that developed between you and them. And that's what made their classes become alive and their words that you're reading now come alive.
That's true. You know, I've never heard anyone explain about the relationship between a therapist and about two people as you have explained it. That's very interesting. And looking back on it and, you know, my own counseling practice, I think you're right. It's amazing, but I've never heard anyone describe it. And I just want to get clear that I think that there might be different planes of existence, so to speak. And I don't want everyone to think that I've taken, you know, all of therapy and dusted and thrown it out. It's only that the therapist should know that this is like a plane of existence. And the job is to help the client, the patient, whatever you call it, to get through and see the light and not to get stuck in endless mental discussions. That's my thing. But I love what you just said. And I think I'm going to add that to my harangue of therapy when I, the next Sufi camp I'm at and I start to diminish all therapists. I like that.
So we've talked about this, you and I, before. I mean, when we were getting to know, well, after we got to know each other, there was a space before I saw, because we haven't, since Israel, I think we've only met in person one other time. It was a few years after that. And it was in Sarasota. I don't know if you remember this. You were part of a camp and I was there and I was excited to see you and Davey. And I had to really work to get a lunchtime with you, to have some time just with you and Davey and Kathleen and me. Do you remember this at all?
Vaguely.
Vaguely, right. And you got on our case. I mean, I'm trying to have, I don't know what I was trying. And you and Davey both, Davey is his wife, by the way, just got on our case about, be careful. Watch the titles. Watch it when there's any title. If somebody wants to give you a title, be careful. And it's like, what would you like for lunch, Iqbal? And you were just, I remember this. And you just wouldn't let go.
So? Are we revisiting? So what?
This is your introduction to talk about, you have some feelings about that?
Yeah, I do. Oh, now that you mention it. A few feelings. Look, either I made this up or I read it somewhere, but the Buddha said, if you put on a coat of I, the second you put it on, you forget who you are and you become the coat. I, Iqbal Lewis. Oh, I, Sheikh Iqbal. Oh, now I'm a Sheikh. And then I take that coat off and as I go up the ranks, oh, I, Murshid Iqbal Lewis. And then I take that off. And the problem is that I would have to deal with myself and believing every coat I put on. But what about the poor people who are around me? One day when I first came, Jamshid, who's a renowned, anyway, he was a Sufi, probably still is, said to me, Iqbal. And I said, what? He said, beware the group mind.
Yeah.
You know, are there real murshids? Yeah. They're real merchants.
Well, Merchant Sam had a title and he used it all the time, right?
But he said before he took it, he had an illuminated disciple. And what Davey and I were haranguing you and Kathleen about was, if you take it and it fits, then you're stuck. Because we are not sheikhs, we are not merchants, we are the Buddha. We are Buddha nature, which is just a word. We're the immortal, eternal, that which is present in everything and affected by nothing. Now, being an Aries, I'm terrifically impatient and I don't know if I have the patience to work everybody through this. And so I'm just where I am and I'm saying what I'm saying. And for most people, it's too rough and rugged, but it's I don't know what Murshid believed, but I know that Joe Miller did not. Here's what he used to say to us. There's very little of any difference between a sheikh and a jerk.
I have never heard that.
Yeah, and he said it not once, but several hundred times to me. And, you know, by then I think I had become a sheikh in the Sufi Order, and he'd say, well, there's no difference between a jerk and a sheikh. And then I'd think, is he talking about me? So titles can be beguiling.
Yeah.
We're trying to withdraw ourselves or understand or live in this Maya, the all-consuming illusion. And all I'm saying to people is be careful, you know, be careful. And that's what we were saying to you and Kathleen that day. Just be careful.
Right. We heard you. Not sure how well we followed your advice, but
it doesn't matter if you followed or not. That doesn't matter because, well, actually, you didn't follow my advice. What? But it got in there, and that's right. That's what it is.
You have the same feelings about organizations, right?
Yeah, I do. I guess essentially, somewhat, yeah. You're pushing me into these... into a hole here. Not all organizations, not every organization all the time. How about that?
That's
but
right.
Essentially, look, the real issue here is it's not the people with titles and it's not the organization. It's the Marid that I'm interested in. It's the person who comes seeking the truth. And I think that a teacher can only project the truth if the teacher knows the truth. I think an organization like, you know, to use a metaphor, like in Judaism, they have the Ark. And in the Ark is the Torah. So the Ark is a symbol of something that contains the Torah. And on the Torah are all the holy words of Moses and whatever, Abraham and whatever. And so to me, that's what an organization should be, an Ark that contains the truth.
I really like that. I've been referring to it as a library, but I like the Ark better. So you can take my thing about psychiatric relationships and I'll take your thing about the Ark.
It's great. But you have to realize if I take it, I'm going to say it back to you. I'm going to say, what, dude, do you realize that? You know, so you'll be hearing it. And then you'll have to say, oh, my God.
At least that means I get to talk to you more and more. So that's good. Yeah. And I don't want to put you in a hole. I mean, I know that not every organization is the same, but I also know that you have some strong feelings about that. And we have strong feelings about that, that sometimes the titles and the organizations get in the way. Now, this is me, what I've taken from it, get in the way from awakening, from the relationship developing that leads to awakening. It's supposed to help that. It's supposed to be a container for that, both in terms of content, you know, the intellectual stuff, the teachings, all of those. I mean, I really like what you said. Those words are supposed to jump off the page. They're supposed to somehow come to life and make you come to life. And the whole point for me of having a teacher or being part of a community and an organization is to allow everybody to come to life. Organizations that don't do that, even when they mean well, get in the way. That's what I wanted to, I'm not trying to put you in a hole. I just think that's something we've talked about and something that I found really important in my relationship with you.
Well, that's how I believe. And that's what I believe. And, when I lived with Murshid Sam, there was a letter thumbtacked to the wall, and it was from Paul Reps. Some of you might know Paul Reps, some of you don't. Paul Reps was an original disciple of Inayat Khan and Murshid Sam's guru brother. The letter read the following, essentially, you know, who even knows if we got the letter today, if it would say anything about what I'm saying, but here's what I think the letter said. There are people who claim to be teachers with 1,000 murids, but you are a real Sufi. And this was an acknowledgement from Paul Reps, who knew Murshid Sam and studied with, you know, was Inayat Khan's disciple. And it's a high compliment. So quantity or quality?
Right. Right. Again, I think anything, organizations, communities, to me, they're containers. You know, I remember when I was doing some teaching about spiritual guidance, you know, there's a whole series of teachings and how do you decide when you're going to assign a certain practice and how do you evaluate levels that people have. And then I found some teachings from Murshid Sam and Shamsher, who you also knew, we haven't talked about yet. And I fell in love with them. And part of it is, and I think it was Murshid Sam who said, you never take bayat initiation with an organization. You take it with a person. And that really hit home. Because that's been my experience. Yeah, I mean, I found this person through an organization. I found you through Shahabuddin. So, but he was part of an organization, so I don't know. But I can find some people through the organization. But once that relationship develops, whoa, that's what's really real. That's what I found anyway. So that, yeah, I can relate to an organization and the organization is like an ark. It contains things, including people, and allows people to be together and to associate. But the relationship needs to come alive and it needs to be honored. And I think that was really important to Murshid Sam. I mean, he was all about relationships. And I never met him, but what I learned from you and Davey is, I mean,
well, what do you think transmission is?
Yeah, right. Talk about that.
Well, transmission's heart to heart.
Yes, right. Right. And nothing should get in the way of that.
And nothing should get in the way of that. It's heart to heart.
Right. We have a question in the chat. I don't want to ignore these. Iqbal, will you please share about Murshid Hassan and the way Hadrat came into the zikr practice?
Yes, I will.
So first explain the terms, please.
A hadrat is the ceremony and zikr is the ceremony, and they mean to remember. Remember what? Remember who you are. Because when we're doing the zikr, what we're saying is nothing exists. There is nothing except Allah. And that means us. It doesn't mean, I don't do the zikr which says, La ilaha illallahu except Iqbal and Wadud. No, it's everything. You know that. That's what it means. So what you're saying is nothing exists except God. Nothing exists except God. Nothing exists except God. So the Hadrat as, so Murshid Hassan, it's a long story and I'm not going to tell it all, but I meet this throughout and this and that and this and that. This Murshid who lived in Jordan, Murshid Hassan. And through all a series of events, he's back to America. And the second time I'm his host, which means he's staying in my house. He formed big hadrats and hundreds. The community was like, if you said there's going to be a hadrat, then 100, 200 people would show up that night into the school across the catty-corner to where we are. So one day, now I'm not musical at all. At least I wasn't then. I mean, zero. And Shabda and I somehow became Murshid Hassan's helpers, we'll say. And so one day we're doing the hadrat. I'm in the circle and Shabda's out there with a big bass drum. And Murshid Hassan walks in. And as he passes me, he hands me the cymbals. And I look at them and I think, what am I supposed to do with these? Because I didn't even know how to put them on, let alone play them. And then he said in Arabic, you're going to play that. I didn't know the tune. I didn't know how to play them. There were 200 people in the room. I started to sweat profusely. I mean, profusely. That I remember. And Shabda comes over and he shows me how to put them on. And then he says, here's the tune. Da-rum, da-da-da. Da-rum, da-da-da. But to me, it sounded like da 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 da, clang, 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 clang. I didn't get it. So I stepped out there because I had to. And they started the zikr, la ilaha illallah. And I played clang, bang, clang, bang, bang. And apparently no one cared. And Murshid Hassan cared the least of all. And then, because he lived in my house over the next ensuing 4 or 5 weeks, he taught me how to play the cymbals, sing it, and what the rhythm was. With a lot of help from Shabda, who kept going, da rum da da da, da dum da da da, you know, and I keep running up to him, what's the tune? What's the tune? So that's what happened. And then it's just not the rhythm, it's the heart that we worked on. And then I learned that you start off one place and you end up another place and you keep going deeper and you keep waking yourself up to be sincere and to call out and make every second a prayer to God. La ilaha illallah. Nothing exists but you. And then, you know, at some point your heart can catch on fire.
Yeah.
And you're just like, the least of it is you're feeling good. And that's how it happened. And then he would sit in my house and he would teach me to play the drum, doom, doom, dot, 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 and to sing. And there was no sense protesting that you didn't know how to sing because he wasn't interested.
I love that story. Thank you. So those of you on the call that are in zikr training, we have a group that's encouraging each other to lead zikr. I hope you heard every word he said. I had that. It was a really visceral experience that I've shared with some people. I'm an amateur drummer. I kind of taught myself, and I learned how to drum for zikr. And I realized gee, I learned this and I know how to keep a beat. And people that I was supporting when they were leading Zikr, they appreciated it and liked it. And I was learning as I was going, and, you know, things seemed to be going okay. So I decided I'm going to encourage people to do that. And so we started having some meetings, and I started to teach them the basics of drumming, and they got all excited. And I asked the Zikr leader, is this okay? And the Zikr leader said, absolutely, I love it. And then one person, not in the group that was learning how to drum, people went out and bought drums and big smiles. And one person made a critical comment in public. And I wanted to cry. Nobody brought a drum back again, ever. And I would say, come on, the Zikr leader says this is okay. We need nobody. Nobody brought the drum back. So to hear you say the Mershi goes in and hands you cymbals and you are just going clank, 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 and nobody cared because the heart was in it. That's it. That's it. And by the way, they weren't that bad. They were pretty good. But one critical comment.
Oh, right.
One critical comment just made all the self-consciousness come back. No heart, no warmth. No one was willing to try it again. That's not Zikr. That was like, oh my goodness. It just broke my heart. It took years to try to get something like that back again. And even then, it never got to people feeling free to come in and just be together and to play together, to remember whatever you want to call it, you know, remember the divine. You know, and I get it. I mean, if somebody was going off clank, clank, clank without any heart, yeah, right, that can be annoying. But that's not what these people were like, and that's not what you're describing.
No.
So, yeah, thank you. That's.
And look, people come to the Zikr, and Davey and I get tons of requests. Can we play at your Zikr? Can we play? And I say, have you ever played at a Zikr? And they're like, no. Then I say, no, you can't. And I don't know what it is, but let's say that someone's playing and they go off on their own. You know, like, do you ever see those rock and roll things where suddenly someone goes, and they just go off on their own thing? Well, if someone goes off on their own thing, we stop them, but it doesn't stop the Zikr. You know, one thing I would like to share is that Murshid Sam, you know, to use the word yell, Murshid Sam, did he yell? He yelled at me. Some people from the outside would say he yelled at me a lot, but it never hurt, and I never got crestfallen because of it. But it's not that he didn't use his power to get right. The point across.
Right.
Plenty of times.
Right. Yeah, I think that's important too. I agree with you. People speak in all different tones of voice. So one of my favorite stories about one of my big role models is my high school English teacher who recently died. And he was a new teacher, and I was a sophomore in high school. And I just couldn't believe this. He, you know, I was in a preppy school, but we had our little collection of, this was back in the 60s, so tight pants, white socks, slick back hair, kind of like Fonzie on TV. And some people who were getting thrown out of other classes because they were pushing the rules and blah, blah, blah. So this guy was teaching poetry. And I remember looking in amazement, all of the class, but these kids in particular, were just eating out of his hands. And he would ask one of them, he asked them to recite the poem he was supposed to memorize for homework. And the kid stands up and he flubs it. And the teacher relatively loudly says, get to the back of the room. And the kid says, oh, and he goes to the back of the room. It was the most loving thing. I mean, he motivated us so much that these kids said, we want to show off our poetry. And he organized the first annual poetry extemporaneous speaking festival at the local college. And he invited high schools from all around. These were kids that were getting thrown out of other classes because they weren't following the rules, because they wouldn't do their homework. And this teacher could yell at them from the depth of his heart, tell them to go stand in the back of the room, and they're eating it up and loving it. And you're right. His yelling was out of love, and you could feel it. You could feel it in his, you could just feel it in the atmosphere in the room.
Davey and I were talking today. We remembered the moments that Joe Miller, like there'd be 80 people sitting in the park, and someone who shall be go unnamed was walking, and Joe would scream out, "Look at that conceited, look at that conceited ass." And he would berate. And by the time the guy reached Joe, he was in ecstasy. And then there was another one where Joe berated someone, and they never even cared. And no one cared because there was so much love.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So maybe that's the secret. Doesn't matter what you say. It's if you have love, you can say almost anything.
Yeah.
How about that?
I like that too. We can share that one.
Well, you know, there's the story about this great sheikh, and every day at 3 o'clock, he gave a lecture and everyone came, the whole town. And then one day he couldn't do it and his son came and was giving the lecture, and it was all about, the divine and all this erudite stuff, and everyone was bored to death and falling asleep. And then the teacher rushed in and he said to everyone, "I'm so sorry I'm late. I had trouble with my chickens." And everyone went into samadhi.
Yeah. We're dancing around something.
We're dancing around. Don't break the mirror of illusion. You don't really break the mirror of illusion. But so we can talk, we'll say, break the mirror of illusion. Understand that what you're looking for is yourself. Yourself. And when you realize it, you realize it is myself. It's always been myself. It's eternal. It has never not been here. I've just been asleep to it. Do you think that's what we're beating around?
Yeah. And I think it can come in a lot of different ways, but I want to get back to, because you said in your bio, what does this have to do with Iqbal Lewis? And you said, being around illuminated people. And I would stretch that a little. It's like, you know, that sounds like a tall order. You were around Murshid Sam. You know, it's not, but we all have that spark.
We are that spark.
Yes.
More than have it, we are it.
So we don't have to go looking for the one special person who's illuminated and who's the next Murshid Sam. You and I found in each other, when you looked at me and you were ready to grumble about, what do you mean there's another person coming? There's not supposed to be anybody else coming to Israel. And I remember you had a scowl. I didn't know what it was about because I didn't know the story. I didn't know that we were told we weren't going to be there. And you looked at us. And the first thing I think I heard from you is, "Oh, they're okay." And it was like, "I don't even know what you're talking about."
Yeah.
But interestingly enough, so this is about me, but I don't know how else to say this. I have a shy streak in me. It's not as strong as it used to be. But there have been certain people, and you happen to be one of them, where in a split second, something changed. It's like you push a button and the me that I know is in there that I'm too afraid to let out comes out. With no effort, it just comes out. And when you turned to me, you were in a coffee shop, right? In the airport. And I heard you say, "Oh, they're okay." And I looked at you. It was like, I was nervous about going to Israel and da-da-da-da-da. And it was like, oh. And then this Henry came out that it was like, that's interesting. I mean, I'm not sure I thought of it. You know. And then for a while on that trip, just so people know, you were staying at a hotel and Kathleen and I were staying someplace else. The place we were staying at didn't work too well. And we were having more and more difficulty. And finally, Kathleen, I think, is the one who said, "I've had it." And you were leaving little hints. Like, you know, if you need something, you can always call us up. We're at this hotel. And so I finally gave up because Kathleen said, "I've had it." And so we called you up. And what did you say on the phone? You said, "What took you so long?"
Did I?
Yeah, you did. And you got a room for us. And it was a much fancier hotel than I expected. So we go there and we had our first marathon, whatever. Must have been lunch. But anyways, we get there and you were laughing. And I said, what do you mean when you told me what took you so long? And you said, "Well, why do you think I'm in a hotel?" And I said, "Why?" And you said, because I knew that was going to happen. I wasn't going to be part of that. And you were just waiting. Somehow, I took you at your word. What took you so long? We can arrange a room for you. And so is that kind of, I guess what I'm trying to get to is that there was something that happened without effort on my part. I don't think there was effort on your part. It didn't seem like it. It was just a natural unlocking of something that just let this something inside me that often has trouble getting out just came out. And it doesn't go away when I talk to you. It's whether we're on the phone or talking about something serious, it's still there. You know, I hope I do something like that for you, but you certainly do that for me. And that's what I think we're dancing around.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. It's got to be mutual. It is mutual. When I see you, let's put it this way. It's best to say, when I see you, I don't get uptight. And when I see you, I don't put on armor. And when I see you, I don't say, oh, shit. You know, I'm going to be under attack. No.
This is true, right?
I just see a friend and, you know, the heart space is let's just hang out.
And again, just for people on the call, I want you to know, we had an intense couple of years where Iqbal really helped me. So were we just hanging out?
Yeah, we were just hanging out.
I remember telling you, well, maybe I didn't tell you. I was telling my friends. I'd say, you know, I'm talking to this guy and my psychiatric mind is saying, I can tell what's happening. This is a transference reaction. I know damn well it is. And I love it. And I'm glad it's happening. And I can't wait to talk to him again. You know, and it's like, I didn't give a crap that I knew, you know, it was real. It went from some theoretical stuff that I teach people and I analyze about. And it was like, I don't care. It was part of a real relationship. And we were talking about, yeah, you're saying we hung out. We hung out and it was important stuff, stuff that made me cry as well as make me laugh. Yeah, it wasn't just telling old stories and walking through the, you know, you can do that. You can do that kind of work, quote unquote, but there's a naturalness and a realness to it that I've always appreciated with you. That just has always been there. From that first time that we locked eyes, it was like, oh, there's something real here and I can be myself. I don't have to put airs around you. And you don't let me anyways, you usually.
Yeah, well, what else is there but just being? You know, this is the whole thing. There's nothing. What is transference anyway?
I don't think I should tell you.
Okay, don't tell me. Don't tell me. I don't want to know.
Good.
I don't want to know. I don't want to know what it is.
Here's a question, and then we're going to have to start winding down. So this is a big question to come near the end. What about evil? And what about people who do something terrible? I think I understand in a larger aspect, Allahu Akbar, but not so much in an individual.
Okay, first of all, I want to say that Christina wrote something about doing the zikr, the hajra in Africa, where if you're not careful, you can go into a trance state. Mm-hmm. And that the practice really is, this was in the chat, the practice really is to stay present. And I just want to say that that's true, because with Murshid Hasan, he was a powerhouse. And there were times where people like the Kundalini would rise and they'd be jumping up and down going, and we'd all be trying to do the zikr. And then he had this way of making people stop it. So it's like everything else. It's a metaphor for life. We're in it now. Try not to get deluded. Try not to go into a trance, believing the what's before you, but not believing it. Stay present. Evil. Let me start this journey. First of all, there's the divine. Is there a vibration there? I don't know. But as life goes on, or the divine starts to incarnate, the vibrations become, we'll say, thicker and more manifest. There's the elements, the divine vibration falls into the elements, and then the elements are formed. And then the elements come in and they form rocks and vegetables and eventually human beings. The source of all this is the divine. Now, the way Murshid Sam explained evil was that it was an imbalance. And he told us, and I heard him tell me, us, a group, that, and this, remember, this was 51 years ago, he said there will no longer be any more world wars, but there will be an ever-increasing amount of natural catastrophes, which we're now experiencing, until mankind learns to control his Jalali nature. Jalali, the power, the sun, anger, pride, conceit, Jupiterian, the Jalali part of it, rather than, as opposed to the moon, Venus, receiving. And so what he indicated was that until mankind learned to control this and put it back in balance, this kind of stuff would happen. So evil itself is a, he used to say, if you want to know what the devil is, try the word I. And so when we look at it, it's not like there's some standalone thing called evil. There's some standalone thing called imbalance. Our job is to put it back into balance. Our job is to balance ourselves as best we can. And a person, as you got more specific, is just under the influence of this. Because is there something, you know, they can paint all the pictures of the devil they want, but it's just a, to me, it's just a representation of something that's not in balance. And don't think like, oh, when I see a jerk, you know, something that's really bad, don't think I say like, oh, that's in balance. No, I go off on a tirade. I want to beat them to a pulp, smash them to smithereens, shoot them. But deep down, you know, and I once gave this talk and there was a young girl who raised her hand and she said, well, what if your next door neighbor is a pedophile and you see him with young children? And I don't know, I tried to like bullshit around for a second. And she said, no, what if your neighbor is a pedophile and you see him with young children? And I said, I call the police. And she said, thank you.
You're real. You're talking about being real. You can have real emotions. You have to take action in the world. That it isn't all sweet talk. That sometimes
that's all bullshit.
Right.
No, but it is. Oh, is everything nice? No, everything is not nice. Isn't he wonderful? No, he's not wonderful. The whole point is we can't gloss over anything or everything. We just have to see what's going on inside us. It's here. The divine is within us. We are one with it. Our job is to find it, to live it, to be it. And then we can, you know, read a lot of books and worry about. Murshid hate good guyism. Oh, yeah. Okay. My last thing. Some of you have heard this 24,000 times. Try to stay awake. So, we're in Murshid's class, and he tells us this story. Jesus Christ appeared to me, he said. And when Jesus Christ appears, I listen. I decided not to argue with him. Can you imagine? So that really caught my attention. I was like, yeah, Jesus appeared to me. Anyway, he caught my attention. And what he said was, they had a long talk, at the end of which Christ said to him, Sam, all your disciples, which is all of us, whatever we call our teacher, will become illuminated if they beware the misguided concept of good guyism. Good guyism. You got to figure it out for yourself. But the beginning thing is kissing people's ass so they'll love you. That's my initial surface definition of good guyism. Why?
I love it. It's a good definition.
And it gets more profound from there. The misguided concept of good guyism.
Right.
And that's, you know, saying, oh, everything's wonderful when it's not wonderful.
Somebody in the chat wrote toxic positivity.
Exactly.
Right.
So this is a phrase that you need to work out yourself. Beware the misguided concept of good guyism. I was once, you know, spieling about this at a seminar, and someone said, well, now that we hear you talk about it, no wonder you have so few friends.
We're going to have to end.
Okay.
You have any last words, or was that your last word?
Well, my last words are my first words, and that is seek. It's in the Bible. Seek the kingdom of heaven, whatever that means, that's within you. Don't be fooled by anything else. The reality resides within you, and you can find it and experience it, and you will discover it's you. It's your innate Buddha nature, yourself, the divine Allah, Ram, Krishna, Shiva. That's what you are. That's my final word. That's my final, you know, I don't want to sound pompous, but that's the thing. So seek that, search for that.
Thank you so much, Iqbal. And you all heard Iqbal promise that he's going to come back and do another one of these, right? You're all witnesses to that. Thank you so much.
I didn't hear Iqbal say that.
Oh, I'm sorry. We should.
Now, look, I'll come back and say another. And I almost could promise. I don't want to promise. But you guys have to decide, well, what did this guy actually say? And then you said, well, amongst his blabbling, and he said that to search within myself and see what happens and beware the misguided concept of good guyism on the way. So if I want him to show up again, I think I'll actually take the search inside, whatever that means. And then we'll see if he'll come back. Otherwise, what's the sense?
Good challenge. Good deal.
Right. What I'm saying to people now is, you know, they call, I say, you want to talk to me and work with me? Do what I say. Try it out, for Christ's sakes. What's the difference of if you don't try it? You know, and if it doesn't work, say you're full of shit, Iqbal, and that didn't work. But you get what I'm saying? You got to try it. It's for the doing. Mercy Tam said, we're interested in techniques that work. Techniques that work, not theories about them. Sufism, he quoted Al-Ghazali, is based on your experience, and nothing else. So let's get real and strive for the divine. Write down your experiences, and we'll come back and talk.
I love you, Iqbal.
What does this mean, demonstrated? From Rahim to everyone, demonstrated. What does that mean?
I think it's another way of you telling us, demonstrate it before you come back.
That's right. To yourself, you have to say, I feel like shit, or I feel great. Okay, goodbye. Om Adiyo.
If you find yourself enjoying our podcast, please do us a favor and spread the word. Tell a friend about it. Give us a review on iTunes or post it on social media. If you or someone you know would like to participate in a future podcast, please connect with us through the Contact Us page. See our events calendar page for dates to our next live podcast recordings. We'd love for you to participate and ask questions. And be sure to check out Joel Lessie's podcast, Unraveling Religion, on your favorite podcast app. Alchemical Dialogues are live and unscripted conversations recorded on Zoom, brought to you by the great folks of Amber Light International, a nonprofit organization co-founded by Henry Curtella, MD, and Kathleen Fitzpatrick, LCSW. We choose topics from our current social and cultural climate with an emphasis on humanism and spirituality.